Joe Simpson had climbed 60 different mountains of various slopes and sizes when a friend showed him a photograph of the biggest unclimbed face in the Peruvian Andes. The mountain was very steep and technically very difficult to climb. It was almost all ice with very little rock. Simpson, then 25, and his partner Simon Yates, 21, knew they could climb it and set out for an adventure that forced them into life and death choices. Simpson has written an account of his experience in a new book called Touching the Void. In it, Simpson admits to moments of stomach-clenching fear, but says it's worth it.
It's putting yourself in a potentially dangerous position, but making it safe, knowing that you are safe because of your experience and whatever your climbing ability is. It's life-enhancing to climb. It makes you aware of perhaps your own mortality. It shows you sides of your fears and your strengths that you wouldn't necessarily find in normal life.
You climbed to the top of a 21,000-foot peak in the Peruvian Andes, which was the setting for this extraordinary adventure of yours, in June of 1985. How do you choose your mountains to climb?
Well, with this particular one, we wanted to find a mountain that was unclimbed, and a friend of ours had been to Peru, and he said Sula Grande has the biggest unclimbed west face. But we felt confident that we could climb it, which we did.
And you and your climbing associate, Simon Yates, had reached the peak of the mountain. You took the photographs at the top, ate some chocolate, and then felt a keen sense of anticlimax. It should be what would seem to an outsider a very exhilarating moment, yet it seems like kind of a downer for you.
Well, it's both, really. The anticlimax comes from the fact that you've planned this expedition for a year, you've thought about climbing the face, you've got yourself psyched up to do it, you know how difficult it is, you're trying your hardest, and you do it, and suddenly you've done it, and you think, what do I do now? I've done it. I mean, it's not to say that you're exhilarated to have climbed the mountain, but really, you don't feel really on top of the world until you've got back down to your camp where you're safe, because you don't want to, count your chickens before your eggs have hatched. You've got a lot more to do before you can get back to safety and think, wow, that was brilliant.
All right, you're on your way down this mountain now, and you're making fairly good progress until you fall. And you don't fall far for a mountain accident, I guess.
15 feet, yeah.
And you break your leg. Your lower bone comes up and shatters your kneecap.
Went straight through my knee joint. Yeah, my lower leg came through my knee joint. A very bad break at 19,000 feet.
Now, this in any other circumstances would have meant what death? Abandonment in the mountains?
Well, if you were in the Alps, a helicopter would come winging along and it would take you off. And that night you'd be in hospital. But in the Himalayas or in the Andes, there is no rescue. There's nobody capable of rescuing you. And we knew that climbing is a two-man team, that it was virtually impossible for one man to rescue another on his own. And I fully expected, when I realized my leg was as bad as it was, that Simon would have to leave me, that he'd have no choice. But he didn't. He tried to lower me down the mountain at great risk to his own life.
And lowering you down the mountain took you over, several thousands of feet?
He lowered me about 3,000 feet. Mm-hmm. He nearly got me down to the bottom of the mountain. And all this time, he never had any anchors. You know, he was just sitting in holes dug out of loose snow because the snow was so bad on the slopes.
Holding onto a rope to which you were attached.
Holding onto a rope, yeah. I mean,
and so he sort of scooted down the mountain in a way.
No, he lowered me the length of a rope, and then when I got to the end of the rope, I'd stand on one leg and dig a hole, and he would climb down to the hole and sit in the hole and lower me another rope length. See what I mean? So he was lowering me and then climbing down. But all he was doing was sitting in small snow holes that he'd dug, seats, and they would be collapsing under his weight and my weight as he lowered me.
And was this in daylight or after dark at this time?
It started in daylight. I broke my leg on the 11 a.m. And he lowered me from then till about 8 o'clock at night, 8:30 at night, in a storm with big spindrift, which is fine powdery snow avalanches pouring down the face and really cold temperatures. And he sustained frostbitten fingers in both hands, lowering me, because he was holding all my weight with his hands, and I was in a very bad state being lowered, because obviously my leg kept snagging on the snow, and my hands were pressed against the snow a lot. I got frostbite in my hands, and unfortunately, because he was lowering me, we could only be lowering in a straight vertical plumb line descent, and in the darkness and in a storm, he lowered me off the edge of an overhanging cliff of ice that he didn't know was there, and suddenly I was ended up hanging in space, and he couldn't pull me back up the rope, and I couldn't climb up the rope, and the seat that he was sitting in was crumbling away beneath him, and he held on to me for about an hour and a half, and at the very last moment he took out a penknife and he cut the rope, because he was about to be pulled off the mountain.
And you fell into a crevasse.
I fell about 100 feet. And
now, this was a choice that your friend Simon made, that in all other circumstances would have sent you to your death.
Yeah, except for the fact that he didn't know how far I was hanging above the ground. I mean, he thought I could be 5 feet above the ground, I could be 100 feet above the ground. But in reality, he had absolutely no choice. He was going to fall off, and if he fell off, he was going to die. Which would be crazy if it was only if I was only going to fall 5 feet. He cut the rope. He only just managed to do it in time. And by great luck, I landed on a sort of ice ledge in the crevasse. Simon couldn't come down in the storm at night and came down in the morning to look for me. Then he saw that I'd gone over this cliff. I mean, he had no idea how big this cliff was, and he realized what had happened. And so he thought, I must be dead. I mean, where he could see into the crevasse, it was just an enormous, enormous drop. So he was certain I was dead, and he left for base camp. But I wasn't dead.
And it took you, what, another 4 days to work your way back out?
Yeah, I had to get out the crevasse.
And hop and
yeah, I got out of the crevasse, took about 12 hours to get out of the crevasse. And then I had to crawl for 3.5 days, nearly 4 days, without food and water. Lost about 45 pounds in weight. And I got back to the camp just in time because Simon was packing up to leave the camp.
It's an extraordinary story of survival. You know, part of the pleasure of being a mountain climber is that sense of isolation, I think, that you feel on top of a mountain. But then there's that sense of isolation of being in a crevasse that nobody knows where you are and thinks that you're gone.
Yeah, I mean,
a bottomless crevasse.
Yeah. I couldn't think really of a worse way to slowly going mad in the depths of this crevasse. And I don't know, the worst thing about the experience in many ways was the loneliness. I've never, ever had a period of my life where I've never spoken to somebody, I've never heard someone's voice, you know, three and a half days. By the time I got to the camp, I was delirious, and my mind was also very badly affected by what had happened. And Simon as well. I mean, Simon had been suffering terribly from guilt and thinking, you know, could I have done any more? Was there anything more I could have done? And where, in fact, he'd put his life on the line to save me.
Is this the sort of decision that you would have talked about in advance, or something you both understood as mountain climbers was the kind of choice that you'd have to make? Those are profound life and death decisions.
Yeah. You've got to understand as well, this is very unusual. This rarely is. I don't think this has ever happened in mountaineering. It's not all like this. But we were aware, as climbing as a two-man team, that if one of you got hurt very high in a mountain, you were both in serious trouble. But these aren't decisions that you take every time you go climbing. I mean, you don't often get in these set of circumstances.